We start out the second half of Chapter 13 with law about generic advertising. Generic advertising is advertising that is paid for by an industry, like the egg industry for the Incredible Edible Egg campaign to eat more eggs, the Got Milk campaign the milk producers took out, Beef It's What's for Dinner, that's another regulated industry. These industries, each company pays in money to advertise generically to increase market for their product or service. Sometimes some companies are not very interested in providing advertising that isn't particularly for their particular company. And that's what gives rise to a couple of cases here. These cases here, there are two of them, and they come out differently, and they turn on the magic phrase regulatory marketing scheme. We'll talk about that in a minute. Let's start out with the Glickman case. Glickman case is a California case. It is about California fruit tree growers. There's peaches, nectarines, and plums, and boy, do they look good. The fruit tree growers were part of a California program. They paid in money that had part of the money going toward generic advertising, eat more peaches, okay, for peaches, plums, and nectarines. One organization, one grower, didn't really want to pay that generic advertising fee, and so they challenged the law, okay? The Supreme Court took the case and they said the law is fine. They didn't even bother to apply the Central Hudson case, right? They didn't even bother with that test. They simply said, look, the growers can put out any other messages they want to. There is no prior restraint on what they can say or can't say. They are not forced to support anything that they are not interested in or any political or ideological view that they don't agree with. Clearly, they're interested in increasing consumption of their products. So what's the big problem here? Right? Growers, the court said, stand to benefit economically from this, quote, forced speech. Even though they're not really thrilled about having to pay for generic speech, it certainly isn't a message that they would disagree with. Okay, so the California law was upheld. Fast forward a couple of years to 2001 and the mushroom growers. Mushroom growers, in this case, are part of a federal program. And the federal program was used primarily to fund generic advertising, buy more mushrooms. Okay? Now you might think Glickman came out where the law was okay. This law should be okay too, right? Generic advertising, A-okay. No, the Supreme Court said. The magic words are regulatory marketing scheme. Okay, Justice Kennedy took a look at the cases and he said, okay, Glickman is different. The Glickman case is different because a large part of the funding that the fruit tree growers pay into goes toward things other than generic advertising. Let me give you an example. Let's say that I pay $100, I'm a nectarine grower in California, and I pay $100 to the California Regulatory Board. 50 of that maybe goes toward lobbying and lobbying expenses. Maybe 20 of that goes toward office space and office supplies. Maybe another, 20 of that goes to something else, maybe salaries. And maybe 10 of that money, $10 of that money, goes toward generic advertising, eat more nectarines. In this case, in the Glickman case, virtually all of the $100, so let's say I'm a mushroom grower, 99 out of my $100 or $100 would go toward generic advertising. Bottom line, the court said, is if the money is primarily or solely spent on forced speech, it's unconstitutional. If an industry is part of a regulatory marketing scheme, that is, the monies that are gathered by the regulatory board are used for a lot of different things and not just advertising, that tends to be okay. If the growers are simply paying for generic advertising, like the mushroom growers were here, the law is not okay. Essentially, the court said, the constitutionality of an individual campaign is judged on how regulated the industry is and whether or not the industry relies on cooperation or competition. Mushroom growers tend not to have to worry so much about cooperating with each other to sell. Fruit tree growers in California were in this cooperative marketing scheme. So bottom line is the term regulatory marketing scheme. If an industry is part of a regulatory marketing scheme, generic advertising is okay. If they're not part of a regulatory marketing scheme, that is, if all the money that they pay in goes toward generic advertising, that's not okay. You don't have to agree, you just got to know. All right. Let's turn now to corporate free speech. Corporate free speech began to be an issue essentially in the 1970s, where corporations were interested in beginning to affect political campaigns. The lead case for a very long time was the Bilotti case, First National Bank versus Bilotti. It was a Massachusetts law that forbade corporate advertising for or against ballot measures, except when the measure may materially affect the business. So in other words, for example, a banking industry couldn't spend a whole lot of money to affect the outcome of a particular election unless there was a measure in that election that would materially affect their business. Okay, the Supreme Court overturned that Massachusetts law and basically said there's no First Amendment guarantee of a special right of access for corporations. So we're going to see that gets adjusted a little bit when we get to the Hillary case, the Citizens United case that just happened in 2010. But, the court said, when the media agrees to accept corporate ads, the states can't prohibit that merely because the speech comes from a corporation. We start to see the fruition of this idea in the Citizens United case. The court actually gave us something called the corporate speech test. I'm not entirely sure whether the test is outdated or not. Generally speaking, I don't tend to put it on the exam, but you should be aware of it. It's a consolidated Edison case, and the court provided that the government must meet one of the three following tests to make sure that non-commercial corporate speech is okay. First of all, the restriction on that speech has to be either a precisely drawn means of serving that compelling state interest, or the restriction fulfills a significant government interest and restricts only time, place, and manner, or is a narrowly drawn restriction on speech in certain specialized circumstances, like on a military base. Now, as we're going to see, Citizens United turns a lot of these rules on their head. It's a hugely important case. Let's turn to it now. It had to do with a production called Hillary the Movie, okay? It was created by a group called Citizens United. Now, there are a fair number of restrictions on campaign finance. A bunch of cases that are discussed a little bit in your book that I'm not going to focus on here. A lot of those were called into question by this case. What ended up happening was the court heard oral argument. And instead of deciding the case in 2009 after it had heard the oral argument, the court kind of gave us a cue that this was going to be a big deal by putting the case over for another year to hear re-argument. Okay? And they were focusing at the time on the constitutionality of limiting corporate independent spending during campaigns. All right? What does this mean? This means that companies like Xerox or Dell or Apple were questioning whether or not they could spend their money directly on supporting of particular candidates or ideas in a campaign. Okay? It's kind of a big deal because a lot of these corporations are very, very, very wealthy. If, for example, Exxon decides to throw its, you know, political funding behind a candidate, they could easily outspend anyone else in the campaign. So this is a very hotly watched case, very hot topic. How did it turn out? Well, so long to those restrictions, all right? Justice Kennedy writes that restrictions on independent political spending cannot rely on the identity of the speaker. What's interesting about this case is that the majority opinion used the term blog for the first time. Those of us who are interested in watching how the Supreme Court deals with new technologies were really interested in this. The court said that spending money is equal to speaking, and therefore it cannot be regulated without a really good reason. Bottom line, corporations can spend as much as they'd like in-house cash on politics. Now, there are some restrictions that are in the states that are being challenged here and there, but by and large, corporations have a lot more freedom to be able to spend their money to affect political campaigns. Okay? We're not entirely sure if this applies to labor unions. The question was sort of left open by the court, but it would stand to reason that if a labor union is spending money and that is considered to be speech if by a corporation, it should be considered to be speech by a labor union as well. All right? Justice Stevens, in what some people called his last hurrah on the Supreme Court, read a very bitter dissent from the bench and said basically corporations are not the same thing as human beings. He wrote, and I quote, "The court's blinkered and aphoristic approach to the First Amendment may well promote corporate power at the cost of the individual and collective self-expression the amendment was meant to serve. It will undoubtedly cripple the ability of ordinary citizens, Congress, and the states to adopt even limited measures to protect against corporate domination of the electoral process." Bottom line, says Stevens, this case is misguided. Okay, the case is misguided because it throws open the door for corporations to essentially run political campaigns. Whether or not that'll be the case, I don't know. Stay tuned. We've had an election series right now, as it was demonstrated that not even a lot of money necessarily wins campaigns, but still, certainly campaign finance has a lot to do with the ability of a candidate to get elected. If a candidate is outspent, oftentimes that candidate loses. So maybe Stevens is right, or maybe the majority, in saying that we should not be restricting speech simply because a corporation wishes to make it, is right. I guess we'll wait and see. Very important case. I anticipate that this is going to continue to be litigated in different cases all throughout the country as we try to figure out what the case means beyond the Supreme Court. Okay. Let's talk about public relations speech. For you public relations folks, this is your case, and it's not even a very satisfying case in terms of outcome. The case is called Nike versus Caskey. Nike had run a public relations campaign that had talked about its benefits in its Southeast Asian factories and making its tennis shoes and athletic apparel. It said, you know, we're really good civic citizens in our host countries. We're responsible. We work with the communities. We provide good labor. We provide a lot of jobs. We're really good corporate citizens. Mark Caskey is a consumer advocate, and he cried foul. He took apart this public relations campaign and said, okay, Nike, you made a whole bunch of misstatements here in your public relations campaign. A lot of these things that you're telling to the public are just wrong, and I want to sue you on behalf of the consumers under consumer fraud laws. Okay? So it goes to the California Supreme Court in April 2002. The California Supreme Court said that the First Amendment did not prevent Nike from being sued under these state consumer protection and fraud laws when Nike has presented as fact statements about their labor policies. So in other words, the California Supreme Court said, go ahead and sue Nike. Nike takes it to the Supreme Court. And the question before the Supreme Court was whether public relations speech like this was to be considered as commercial speech or political speech. Nike, of course, wanted it to be political speech so that the mistakes that they made would not be held accountable under the very strict, you know, commercial speech doctrine under Central Hudson. Mark Caskey and his crew want public relations speech in general to be regulated as though it is commercial speech and thus bound by Central Hudson. So go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court punts the football away. They had a one-sentence ruling in June of 2003. The writ of certiorari is dismissed as improvidently granted. In English, the court decided not to decide. They said, essentially, we granted the appeal prematurely. The case is not yet ripe to be decided. So we're going to send it back. We're going to keep the lower court's opinion there. It ended up settling with Nike allocating a couple $1 million, which is chump change for Nike, and the California Supreme Court decision against Nike stands. Now, for those of us who were interested enough at the time to read the oral arguments, some justices said, you know, we're really not comfortable with this sort of speech being considered commercial speech. We really would prefer that this kind of speech be protected as though it is political speech. So it would have been a win for Nike, they had been able to come to a decision and publish it. However, they didn't, so we don't really know. Bottom line is the Supreme Court has not yet told us whether or not public relations speech, even that public relations speech that deals with political topics like international trade, international finance, etc., is going to be protected as commercial or protected as political. Obviously, public relations firms would like it to be protected as political because it would be a more full protection, and consumer advocates like Caskey and crew would like it to be subject to Central Hudson. We don't know. Stay tuned. All right. Like the FCC is responsible for electronic media regulation at the federal executive level, the Federal Trade Commission, or the FTC, is responsible for advertising law at the federal level. Okay, it was created in 1914 by the Federal Trade Commission Act that was passed in the wake of a number of Food and Drug Administration issues where the initial response by the government had been caveat emptor or buyer beware. And in the wake of the Food and Drug Act and a number of other acts that were intended to protect consumers, the Federal Trade Commission steps in now to make sure that consumers are not getting bamboozled by advertisers. Okay. The Wheeler-Lee Amendments of 1938 were an important set of amendments that allowed the FTC to ban unfair or deceptive ads or practices in commerce. Okay. And essentially what the Wheeler-Lee amendments do is provide the FTC the ability to find a practice deceptive if a product is misrepresented, if information about it is omitted, or another practice undertaken by an advertiser misleads consumers who are acting reasonably to their detriment. For example, let's say that you read an advertisement in the local newspaper that says that on Friday there will be gallons of milk sold for 50 cents at the local grocery store. So you go down to the grocery store with the expectation that you're going to be able to buy a couple of gallons of milk for a buck. Okay? When you get there, the milk, quote-unquote, is sold out. All right? But, says the owner, we have this $5 a gallon milk over here that you can buy instead. They can't do that. It's bait and switch. Okay? That's a deceptive ad practice. Okay? It is essentially misleading the consumer who is acting reasonably to his or her detriment. Okay? You have to tell the truth in an ad. No, you can say, you know, supplies limited or limited to stock on hand, or you can give rain checks. Obviously, you're not going to be able to anticipate how much you're going to sell, but bottom line, you have to make it right for the consumer. Another set of laws that were passed in 1975 was the Magnuson-Moss Act, and that permitted the FTC to regulate against fraudulent ads down to the local level. In other words, the FTC's reach can come all the way down to your local drugstore or hardware store or grocery store. And they can also issue enforceable trade regulation rules. We'll talk about some of those guides and rules in just a few minutes. Some of the things that the FTC has been interested in recently is a set of rules called endorsement rules. These were passed fairly recently in October of 2009. And they're a set of guidelines. Guidelines are passed by the Federal Trade Commission to let advertisers know the kinds of issues that they are going to be looking at in terms of advertising regulation. These guidelines were focused primarily on bloggers and other users of social media. Essentially, what the blogging rules or the endorsement rules say, that if a blogger or other social media user, or anyone frankly, but primarily these bloggers, endorse a product or service, and they have some existing relationship with the company, that needs to be disclosed. Let me give you an example. You guys all know that I have a beautiful cat named Nero. Nero prefers Iams. He likes Iams quite a bit. Actually, I think he'll eat anything you put in front of him, but he likes Iams quite a bit. And so I go on some cat boards, let's say, and I post that my beautiful cat Nero really prefers Iams, and isn't Iams great, and my cat really is healthy on Iams, and it makes his fur all soft and glossy, etc., etc., etc. And I become a fairly active participant on these cat blogs. Now let's say Science Diet, which is another, you know, food competitor, decides that Science Diet wants to get a little piece of the Nero action. So Science Diet emails me and says, hey, Belmus, let's send you a free bag of cat food so you can let your cat try that, and, you know, why don't you review it on the board? So I go ahead and I feed my cat the Science Diet that I got for free, and it turns out that he likes it. Hey, Nero. All right, he thinks it's a great thing. So he eats it all up, and he seems to be happy, and his fur's even prettier. Okay, so I go on my cat boards and I say, oh my God, Science Diet is really wonderful. My cat really loves it. It makes his fur look good, etc., etc., etc. I've endorsed the product. Now, what I have to do to fall into line with the FTC's rules is I have to say, and oh, by the way, I got a free bag of Science Diet from Science Diet. Okay, I simply have to reveal the fact that I got the product for free. Okay? The endorsement counts as any advertising message that consumers are likely to believe reflects the opinions, beliefs, findings, or experiences of a party other than the sponsoring advertiser, even if the views expressed by that party are identical to those of the sponsoring advertiser. Now, let me give you an example of something that would not be an endorsement. Let's say that they send me the bag of cat food and the cat hates it. He throws it up, makes his fur all flat, etc., etc. I post that I don't think that Science Diet is very good for cats. In fact, it made my cat throw up. That's not an endorsement, all right? Because I have dissed on the product, right? It's not entirely clear whether or not a diss on the product needs to be disclosed in the same way as an endorsement would, largely because if I slam on a product and people are reading my views and listening to them, they're unlikely to buy the product, whether or not I got it for free. You can sort of see where there might be a little bit of a difference here. But clearly, an endorsement, if I love the product and I post that, I have to provide information about the relationship that I have with the company. Here are some details. The FTC will look at whether or not the speaker is compensated. So let's say that I get paid to feed my cat different foods and report on that. I have to report who is paying me. Okay, whether that product or service was provided for free, so I have to disclose that I got the free bag of cat food. What I wouldn't have to do is disclose if Science Diet sent me or a bunch of other cat owners, you know, a $5 off coupon for a bag of cat food. If I'm being treated differently, separately, or specially, then I have to disclose that. But if I get a free coupon in the mail that 100 other people or 1,000 other people got, I don't have to disclose that. Okay. If there is an agreement, however, I need to disclose the terms of that. So say I have signed a contract for that for a year I'm going to review products and I'm going to get them for free. I have to disclose that. You know, the length of the relationship has to be disclosed. Any other previous receipts, I've been maybe doing this for a couple of years, I need to disclose that. And any value. Okay. If you blog, and I know a number of students who are bloggers, who are do product reviews for different websites, who are paid to do that, or who have relationships with products and services to post that information around, that's when you have to disclose it. For example, say that a clothing company decides to contract with a student to review clothing on a bunch of different fashion websites. If a contract is signed, that information has to be disclosed, how much they was paid, the length of the relationship, whether the clothing is gotten for free, etc., etc., etc. Essentially, it's simply telling the public that you, as the endorser, have a relationship, and to take that, in a sense, take that review with a grain of salt. Okay? All right. Now, the FTC has a number of different rules that it can use if a company runs afoul of the advertising regulations. The three important ones are the consent decree, a cease and desist order, and assurance of voluntary compliance. The most important one is a consent decree. The FTC will investigate a company and will let it know that formal proceedings will ensue unless the company signs the decree and essentially stops doing the advertising. The company doesn't have to admit that it did anything wrong, it simply stops the ads. As a result, most companies will simply sign it. If they don't, court cases can, you know, can't take place. A cease and desist order happens when a FTC has investigated that there was an unfair deceptive practice and a consent decree may or may not have been signed. It's an additional level of protection for the FTC for consumers. Okay? And an assurance of voluntary compliance is essentially the company making a promise to stop questionable practices in return for the FTC dropping the investigation. All right? And again, no harm, no foul. Most of these tend to be resolved with the FTC engaging in a consent decree.